Welcome to the Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays read by Leighton Pugh.
Townscape, good manners, and gross national happiness. Anne Fairfax. Reframing the concepts city, civility, and capitalism allows an examination of a future that acknowledges a need for a different approach to urban development in this age of climate crisis. Globally accepted spatial, cultural, and economic valuations are being challenged to accommodate the new normal that is rapid urbanization, combined with catastrophic ocean rise. One may see this as an opportunity for urban planners and neighborhood regenerators to recast new strategies towards a more humane and aesthetic-centered approach and step away from business-as-usual solutions. Previously taboo concepts such as beauty and happiness are now legitimately entering discussions on how policy and the built environment can be shaped. Contributions of such disparate disruptors as citizen activist Jane Jacobs, non-profit urban advocates Create Streets, and humanist royals including the Bhutanese King Jigme Singye Wangchuck and Great Britain's Prince Charles are being re-evaluated, and they are being upheld as exemplars rather than outliers. Rethinking the city as townscape marks a return to urban ordering that recognizes the importance of human scale, attachment to place, and visual harmony. Many of the new buildings in cities and the space around them, public plazas, have been characterized by what has been called Corbusianity, that which is influenced by the tenets of the modern movement of the early 20th century, resulting in unornamented surfaces and abstracted forms. This approach to urban planning lacked the ability to generate the messy vitality that Jacobs characterized as an intricate sidewalk ballet. That informal interplay of social interactions amongst many players of all ages, characteristic of an authentic place. The Corbusian order of things, which advocated for a break with the specificity of both past and place, resulted in a reductivist style vacuum and an elitist aesthetic culture, which labelled charm in architectural and urban design as bourgeois and therefore unworthy of use in contemporary practice. Even today, any historic visual reference on a new building is often labelled false sense of historical development, Disneyland or pastiche, by both the historic preservation community and mainstream modern architects. There is growing acceptance that certain visual environments affect mental well-being, and that this can be objectively assessed through qualitative research for use in evaluating healthy aesthetic environments. Citizen activists understand that mainstream corporate and governmental placemaking solutions often fall short and are taking matters into their own hands. An example is the London-based non-profit organisation Create Streets, which recognises the power of research and public outreach and actively conducts independent interviews with pedestrians to understand how environments and buildings are perceived by their users. Create Streets' stated aims are to advance the education of the public in subjects related to the built environment. They are dedicated to understanding the associations between urban form and mental and physical health, and provide training to community groups for neighbourhood planning and urban design activities. Given that 20th century urban planning and development has predominantly instigated an auto-centric mindset that has privileged cars over humans, organisations such as Create Streets are increasingly at the forefront of educating citizens to trust their instincts and voice their concerns when the built environment threatens their health and well-being. Their bottom-up approach to research is conducted through one-on-one polls and surveys regarding simple aesthetic preferences and yield results that can be used by designers and policymakers to shape the look and feel of a neighbourhood development. Alternatively, a top-down approach to neighbourhood planning, yielding successful results, began in 1996 when the Prince of Wales, who has a long-standing interest in architecture and design, donated 400 acres of land that had belonged to the royal family since 1342 for a development. Poundbury in Dorset was planned to meet local housing needs without creating yet another car-dominated single-use zoned housing estate. It is being built in several phases and stands as an exemplar to developers, architects and urban planners for new village creation. It is built with robust traditional materials in styles drawn from the past and is mixed use, from factories to shops to pubs, and its housing accommodates 35% low-income families. The low-income housing is mixed with market-rate housing, removing the stigma of segregation by income. The aspirations of Prince Charles and his visionary urban planner Léon Cria have resulted in an authentic place which, whilst previously mocked by the press and architectural elite, is now being accepted as a real place rather than the Potemkin village it was dubbed while it was being developed.
Hello, I'm Adam Bolton, host of Worldview, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast. On Worldview, with the help of leading historians, scholars and commentators, we explore history, key contemporary challenges and the big questions about our future. Join us and listen to Worldview on engelsbergideas.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
When it comes to the question of civility or good manners, we can turn to the idea of civitas, an involvement in the affairs of the city, implying an assumption of belonging to the physical aspect of the built environment. A citizen's physical and visual engagement through the thoroughfares, public squares and buildings within the traditional city in the pre-modern era usually meant the civic realm you were moving through was built by your grandfather or his grandfather, and so forth. Every successive generation did not generally destroy the previous generation's built environment, but rather added to it incrementally as needed. World Wars, Haussmann's famous tabula rasa for Paris, and London's great obliterating fire of 1666, of course, serve as stand-ins for numerous exceptions. But the general rule was to conserve the best of the past generation's efforts and to build cumulatively, carefully, and for the ages. The criteria for conservation would have been whether a building was stable, purposeful, and lastly, pleasing to look at, that is, beautiful. Vitruvius's three-legged stool of firmness, commodity, and delight could not stand without delight, and as such, beauty holds as much weight as fitness and stability. Fiona Reynolds reminds us that the UK Planning Bill of 1919, the first of its type, had as its aim the home healthy, the house beautiful, the town pleasant, the city dignified, and the suburbs salubrious. She goes on to express the important role of beauty in the built environment. Beauty is not a luxury we can have only when we are rich. It is a way of shaping the changes we need and want, so that they make a positive contribution to everyone's lives, as well as protecting the things and places we most value. With more than 80% of the world's population now living in urban areas, we have to devote more energy and commitment to making them beautiful, satisfying, and human places to live. Tristan Edwards, an architect and urban planner of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, wrote, Good and Bad Manners in Architecture, a treatise on town planning which analysed and judged the new buildings in and around London. Edwards, like others of his generation, was reacting to the new ideology of modernism when he decried the fatal doctrine of the priority of the plan, which the modernists said should form the basis for the composition of the facade. Generations upon generations of architecture students have since been indoctrinated with the notion that the plan is the generator of the public face of the building, to the detriment of the visual built environment. Edwards' premise was that buildings, like people, are instead duty-bound to appropriately present themselves to the public. His anthropomorphic analogy sounds quaint today when one looks at the current comportment and dress of the public. However, there are still standards of behaviour for citizens. One doesn't generally shout on the street, for instance. And the point could be stretched that buildings, like people, should be mannerly, play well with others, and, if at all possible, be beautiful. Since Edwards' era, there have been ever more threats to the traditional city. Neoliberal monetary policy's influence on the shape and space of expanding urban realms on a global scale has had what many consider to be deleterious effects on the civil nature of cities. In pondering the juxtaposition of civility within the context of the city, one cannot help but observe that the new order of global city building is tending toward two antisocial constructs: increasing privatization of public, civic, space, and the building of spatially assertive standalone buildings divorced from cultural contexts, such as Canary Wharf in London and New York's Hudson Yards, both urban developments which bear no references to their locale's climate, history, materials, scale, proportion, or urban context. The urban sociologist Leonard Navarez, cited by the scholar Robert Adam, observes also that historically preserved zones are not exempt from globalized city building, indicating that gentrified historic districts are usually closely tied to economic incentives of globalization. In the case of New York's Ganzevoort meatpacking district, one of many global examples, gritty slaughterhouse squalor was transformed in the span of 15 years and now features such universally recognized modern talismans as a Hermes boutique, a Tesla showroom, and a major contemporary art museum. Scholars such as Anna Minton and Robert Adam are increasingly concerned that ceding public space to corporate interests compromises potential public dissent, essentially replacing the public in public squares with consumers in private squares. This is becoming a well-recognized aspect of modern city life, where newly created public space is in reality private property, ostensibly open for the benefit of the public, usually traded at a cost to the neighborhood for increased height or density. These capitalist-branded buildings and consumer squares don't generally contextually respect their building neighbors, preferring to go it alone through distorted shapes and shiny skins. In many cases, such as in extreme auto-centric environments like Dubai, the buildings may not even acknowledge the presence and accommodation of humans and their fragile and sensitive needs, such as knowing where the door is. These public plazas also tend to have a sameness of design, something that Jonny Aspen, the Norwegian professor and urbanist, calls zombie urbanism. This is the privatized square with neat and tidy street furniture, lacking in social life, which cannot overcome the chilling effect of territorially patrolled and controlled commercial interests. By leaving placemaking to corporate interests, city governance is relinquishing its responsibility for protecting the commons, setting dangerous precedents for the future of democratic discourse. Can capitalism, GNP, coexist with GNH, gross national happiness? GNP is a primitive tool, with accumulation as ostensibly the only measure for success. Such a blunt instrument has driven us to this current desperate place of mass consumerism, contributing to the degradation of the environment. Looking at alternate models, Bhutan developed an entirely different measure of their country's success, calling it the Gross National Happiness Index, which measures the collective happiness of their nation. This concept was adopted as an indicator in 2008 and espouses a holistic approach to development. The four pillars of GNH are good governance, sustainable, equitable socio-economic development, environmental conservation and diversity, and preservation and promotion of culture. There is a Bhutanese GNH commission that evaluates and implements policies and measures the happiness and well-being of the populace of almost 1 million. In June 2019, it was announced that salaries of teachers, doctors, nurses, and medical staff were to be raised, with these professions becoming the highest-paid civil service positions in the kingdom, in recognition of the long hours, job stress, and worth to the nation. This overhauls the current civil servant hierarchy that rewarded administrators with the highest pay and perquisites. This type of legislation is demonstrating to the world that Bhutan's commitment to evaluation and improvement of living standards is an ongoing experiment. The areas of interest are not just the expected ones for governments such as education, health, and the environment. Also included are community vitality, time use, psychological well-being, and cultural resilience and promotion. A discussion on development and how it is tied up with core values and motivations of a municipality invariably leads to questions of how economic globalism physically manifests itself. Putting the small nation of Bhutan aside, by contrast, a current example of development on a mega scale is the latest and largest developer-led urbanism in American history, $25 billion to date. Hudson Yards, located on the far western side of Midtown Manhattan in New York, is a mixed-use project consisting of retail, residential, office, and recreation, all built to international style standards. At a time when New York City is undergoing massive change in the form of gentrification and is suffering from the same digital retail apocalypse as the rest of the country, Hudson Yards arrived fully formed and leased, complete with a Thomas Heatherwick art stare to nowhere, described by Alexandra Schwartz writing in The New Yorker as a triumph of vapidity, banal to its hollow core. Perhaps the public has had enough. Michael Kimmelman, the architectural critic of the New York Times, called Hudson Yards a supersized urban-style office park and a relic of dated 2000s thinking. He goes on to say, it glorifies a kind of surface spectacle, as if the peak ambitions of city life were consuming luxury goods and enjoying a smooth, seductive, mindless materialism, with each building existing chiefly to act like a logo for itself. Even Forbes magazine, whose founder Malcolm Forbes enjoyed the use of his helicopter, an abashedly named capitalist tool perched atop his yacht, often seen anchored in the Hudson River, reports that the shared physical space that Hudson Yards development has created is illusory and inauthentic, and is more concerned with matching the grandeur of Dubai or Singapore than its context in New York. But the critics don't stop at the public space, or what such a project represents in an increasingly unequal world. One critique says the building and material choices of the global 1% developer class are inherently wrong-headed. Oliver Wainwright of The Guardian writes, walking through Hudson Yards feels like browsing a cladding depot, where panels of curtain wall glazing, brushed aluminium, and bits of stone collide in a wonky collage, and describes it as bargain basement buildings by the yard and a blunt vehicle for making money. Returning to the concept that our forefathers were building for the ages, we may be ready to revisit how authentic architecture is made and how it meets the street and engages with its users. Hudson Yards and its failure to impress just may be the bellwether that our love affair with GNP and its narrow measure of consumerism may finally be coming to an end. The collective mainstream media criticism directed at Hudson Yards is not surprising given that most people know the difference between when they are being treated as consumers or being respected as citizens, and reporters and architectural critics are human after all. A commercial mega-development in New York is not unprecedented, so it is not the size and scale of the project that is generally derided. The Rockefeller Center in Midtown was the Hudson Yards of its time, but the difference between the two is stark, coming down to the design. Rockefeller Center features an orderly and rational public space design, which is monumental but not imposing. The chaste and well-crafted quality of architect Raymond Hood's limestone-clad buildings work at all scales, unlike Hudson Yards, which is already showing signs of deterioration. Modern architecture is meant to dazzle from afar, but often literally and figuratively falls apart when examined up close due to tectonic failings. The materiality of Rockefeller Center, the stone and sculptural ornament, all lend delight to the experience at the human level. The New Yorkers among the Hudson Yards critics are perhaps nostalgic for a city that is no more. Jane Jacobs' New York and the New York poignantly described in Vanishing New York, a blog-turned-book which describes itself as a bitterly nostalgic look at a city in the process of going extinct. What is being pined for are the small, fine-grained development projects, such as 19th-century developer-built Greenwich Village, unlikely to be built today, given that it does not contain within it a system that encourages diverse ownership of capital. Hedge funds, insurance companies, global corporate funding, none are interested in the incremental and the well-made, but rather are looking for short-term profits and too-big-to-fail projects. By being large enough, local municipalities may even subsidize projects, as Hudson Yards was with $6 billion of taxpayer subsidies. Municipalities are looking to place large bets, not small, and this excludes the developer who might just be in it for the long term, not simply until the next shareholder meeting. Increasingly, the future is associated with a settlement pattern defined as urban. By 2030, approximately 5 billion people are expected to live in urban areas, placing density of human settlement at the forefront of concern for those policymakers, scholars and professionals hoping to pave the way for a more humane and sustainable urban future. Data from the United Nations Population Fund shows over half of the world's population currently lives in cities, which themselves have grown by 30% in the last 50 years. In assuming that we are to design cities which can meet the goals expressed in the United Nations Brundtland Report, including development that meets the needs of the present generation without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs, it is imperative to bear in mind the values which sustain positive human development: social well-being, environmental protection, and responsible fiscal generation. All should be under consideration when evaluating and managing the inevitable changes to cities as populations escalate, oceans rise, and climate becomes more unpredictable. GNP growth trajectories are tied to increased carbon emissions, currently ebbing and flowing with the economy. Decoupling growth from greenhouse gas is said to be possible, but it must be done through policy, as leaving the change to market solutions will not take us out of the climate change nosedive. And it is not just environmentalists and academics who are espousing fundamental change. The former director of the World Bank, Christine Lagarde, said at the 2016 World Economic Forum in Davos, "We have to go back to GDP, the calculation of productivity, the value of things, in order to assess and probably change the way we look at the economy." Joseph Stiglitz, the noted Nobel Prize winner, said in 2018, "What we measure informs what we do, and if we're measuring the wrong thing, we're going to do the wrong thing. If we focus only on material well-being, we become distorted in the same way that these measures are distorted. We become more materialistic." There is need for action that transcends the market and leaves room for addressing not just economic growth, but environmental and social sustainability. Doing this presupposes a closer look at the values that are guiding society today. Our lives, and the lives of future generations, depend on it.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolpe. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.